listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Towinski and Wes Boss.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Syntax. Today, we're going to be talking all about CSS layout. We got this awesome question come through our potluck button. And if you don't know, our potluck button is where you submit questions to the show, and generally, we answer them on a potluck. However, this question came by John Lynch, who's from west of Ireland, which is kind of fun. And he said, "Dear Wes and Scott, you would make me, and I'm sure many other novice front-end developers, very happy if you could do an episode of Syntax FM and maybe a tutorial on the topic of CSS positioning and sizing." And then he goes into break down this incredibly in-depth CSS layout. So basically, we're just taking this layout that he's given us, and we're going to go through it and talk through some of how CSS works, because it's often an overlooked thing. I even do this myself, where I don't have a CSS course out, and I would love to. People ask me all the time, like, when is the CSS course coming out? Because it's such a... CSS is hard, don't you think, Scott?
Yeah. The biggest indicator that CSS is hard is just how many people have problems with it or hate it or whatever. Or, you know, that classic CSS is awesome mug where the text is going out of the box. I mean, I think that mug right there is an indication of just how hard CSS can be sometimes.
I've got on my laptop, I met somebody at a conference. I'm totally forgetting who this is. Sorry if you're listening, but he printed new CSS is awesome ones where the box just properly fits around it.
Ooh.
And he's like, "I fixed it." And I like that, because
I actually, yeah, I want to get one of those.
Yeah, it's awesome, because like if you do know how to use CSS, you're not going to run into those issues. And that joke and that mug that everyone's talking about is a bit of a thing of the past, I think, because like obviously these aren't issues anymore. It's just that you're having trouble writing it and you need to probably learn it a little bit better.
Yeah. And so I've never been in the camp of CSS sucks. I've always been in the CSS fan camp. And like, I never understood why other people had a problem with it. And maybe it's just because that's where my foundation was, right? My foundation, I didn't come from a computer science background. I came from a design background. And I wanted to, you know, be able to create these things. So, I mean, my whole learning and understanding of web dev primarily resolved around learning CSS to start.
Well, speaking of CSS, we have two awesome sponsors today here. First one is Manning Books. They've got a whole bunch of deals, 40% off all of their books and video courses. Today, we're going to highlight one called CSS In Depth In Motion. So it's in depth and in motion. I think in motion just means that it's a video and not an actual book, from Chris Ward. So you want to check that one out if you're looking to learn a little bit more about CSS. We'll talk about that partway through the show. Our other sponsor today is Sentry. Sentry is going to do all of your error and exception tracking on your client side, on your server side. We'll talk about them a little bit more throughout the show as well. So how you doing, Scott?
Hey, doing good. Just hanging out. I don't know. Getting work done, recording tutorials. Doing what I do, working on the site, Devin, living the dev life. Yeah, it's all good. How about you? How are you doing?
Good. I'm just looking at what my next last couple of days. I am off for the year in this. Today is December 13th. It's Thursday. And I'm looking at doing another 3.5 more days of work. And then I'm done for the holiday. So I'm looking forward to that. We've got some fun stuff planned with the kids. And we always try to maximize that time around Christmas.
Yeah. I was trying to look at the calendar here to see if our audience would be listening to this in the year 2019. Oh, yeah. And maybe you are, but the release of this episode will not be 2019. Unfortunately, the next one will be.
Happy New Year if you are listening to this in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, time travelers.
All right, so let's dive into it. CSS layout. We're just going to go through a whole bunch of different topics related to CSS layout, positioning, display, heights, widths, units. You get the point. And we'll probably get through this whole thing. If not, we'll cut it into a second show as well. So first one is, when do you use the position fixed, static, absolute, relative, and sticky? So when you have an element in CSS, you position it. And by default, it's going to be a position of static. So this is something you're not going to probably apply to any elements unless you're trying to overwrite something that has previously been positioned otherwise. That's static. That's the way it works. The content inside of that element will take up as much space as it needs. And when we say that, we mean that when you put elements on the page and you put content inside of those elements, the size of that element is determined first by whether it's block or inline. We'll talk about that. And generally, they're block and they go 100% across the viewport or of its container. And then the height of it is determined based on the actual content that lives inside of it. So that's position static.
Yep.
It's not all that exciting, but we've got other ones. You want to take a shot at explaining some of these other ones?
Yeah. Let's do a little back and forth here. So the next one on the list, I think of maybe your most used would be position relative. Position relative has a couple of uses, but ultimately what it does is it basically just makes the element positioned relative to its normal position. And one thing that people, I don't think, knew that you could even do with position element is give, or position relative item is to give it a top value and it would actually bump it down. So you could do something where you give your button a position relative and then you give it, when you push it, you know, a top of one and it looks like you're pushing it down a little bit. They used to be that.
Yeah,
hot,
I always
trick.
Did that. I love that.
Yeah, me too. But now a lot of that stuff that you would normally have used for that, now you could just do with CSS transforms anyways. So I'm not typically using the relative to move things around too much anymore, other than, you know, the way it is. But the primary reason why you're using position relative nowadays is really just as a container for a position absolute item. Because when you position an item absolutely, it does so with the container in mind. So do you want to talk about position absolute?
Yeah. So when you're thinking about positioning elements on the page, I always like to tell people, picture a bunch of elements that are standing in line at the grocery store. And by default, all of these elements are positioned static and they just take up as much room as they need. So you might have a little element, you might have a really big and wide element, you might have a very tall element, and however much space that they need, they take up that much space in line. Now, when you position something relative, like Scott said, you have the ability to start skirting it around with trouble. Trouble stands for top, right, bottom, left.
I've never heard that, trouble.
No? No? Oh, man, you're going to get in trouble in this podcast because I use it a lot.
What?
It's the only way I can remember how the shorthand works.
I just think about it as clockwise. It starts at the top.
That's wrong. Clockwise or like never eat shredded wheat. That's wrong. It's trouble.
It is clockwise, though. That's so much easier. It's universal.
When you apply trouble to it, you can skirt it around, but it will still maintain its spot in line. So I always talk to people when I was teaching CSS at HackerU in Toronto, I would always be like, okay, this person's still in line. Maybe they leave the cart there or they put their foot, they leave their shoe, but they're running and grabbing like a chocolate bar from the thing over there. Or they, oh, I forgot to get sour cream. Let me go run and get it. You still maintain your list. However, when you position something absolutely, position absolute, it gives up its seat in line. So it sort of lifts itself up like a ghost. And all the other elements no longer think, okay, you no longer get space in line because you've positioned yourself absolutely. You no longer take up space on the page, and any other relative or static items that come after that element simply just move up. Oh, that guy left.
He just turned into a ghost.
Floated into the air.
Let's just assume everything's normal and take my next button line.
To an absolute element, you can still give things a trouble value. So those TRBL, the top, right, bottom, left values, are going to be relative to the parent container that is relative, absolute, fixed. We'll talk about this a little bit more as well. How do you size something based on its parent? So that's what absolute is. You can use absolute to overlap things as well. So if you need things to obviously overlap each other, you can position absolute them. I would go as far to say in most cases, you probably don't want absolute. And this is coming from if you are a beginner learning CSS. What I see all the time is people say, I want this thing to go here. So I'm just going to position absolute it and then give it the values that I want. And that's not great because of the reason why it loses its space in line. And then designing the rest of your page becomes really hard because you've got this element that doesn't push things up or down depending on how much content is inside of it.
Yeah. And that's why frequently you just see a container that's relative and then an absolute thing. And then maybe the container has some, you know, height and width or whatever. Next up, we have position fixed, which is very similar to position absolute. I think new people can occasionally get a little twisted up with when to use absolute and when to use fixed. Fixed is position relative to the viewport. You'll see position fixed used primarily in things like pop-ups, modals, maybe like an alert, like a toast message or something like that. You'll often see it even like those like full page ad thing takeovers that are like, sign up for my mailing list. Like that's position fixed, right? So position fixed is, again, it's positioning something relative to the viewport. So when you are giving it its top left or top right, sorry, trouble, when you're giving it its trouble coordinates, you're doing so. So the if you give it a top of zero and a left of zero, it's going to be in the very top left of the viewport. No container is going to prevent this from being stuck inside of this thing. It's always going to be towards the viewport. And fixed, I think... fixed is probably getting used less and less, right? I go out of my way to avoid using fixed. There's some like weird bugs in Safari with position fixed, specifically with like text inputs and stuff. And so I've just, for the most part, I find a way to use absolute for things, especially like now that you can do things like portals in React or whatever very easily to take something and put it at the very bottom of your document, like modal, then you can position an absolute and that absolute to the actual viewport rather than something position fixed.
Yeah, fixed has always been an issue in Safari. For many years, we didn't have fixed at all in Safari just because of the way it worked. And now it's still a pain. Same with viewport heights are a pain in iOS because of the way that scrolling works with iOS. When you load the page, it looks fine. But when you scroll, Safari will take the bottom bar and move it out of the way so you get more height on the web page. And that causes this weird like gap where if you are using 100 VH of viewport height, or if you're using position fixed and doing bottom zero, it doesn't actually stick to the bottom because mm-hmm. the viewport is not as big as that. It's such a confusing thing. I have a problem with it right now on my own checkout on Safari, which I'm trying to deal with. It's kind of frustrating.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why, like, I mean, we'll get into viewport units a little bit more in a little bit.
Yeah.
But like, that's one of the reasons why I almost never use VH if I want like something to be exact to the viewport height. Like I'm always using it for like things that are like sort of close to 100.
Okay.
If I just want to make this, I want to make sure this, you know, main element on the page is never less than, you know, 80% of the viewport height. You can do a min height of VH or whatever. So
that's what I use it for almost all the time. Yeah. Let's save those treats though, because there's a lot of viewport heights there. People might not even know what we're talking about. They're pretty handy.
Yeah, I have a note at the viewport heights thing. It just says, can we just talk about how dope viewport heights are? Because I use it for everything.
The last position we have, and this is relatively new, it's called position sticky. We've talked about it on the podcast before. If you go to syntax.fm right now and just scroll the player past where it is, it turns into position sticky. And the way that position sticky works is it's position relative. It just goes where it should be until that thing is scrolled outside of its container. So the example we have is the player for the podcast is, I don't know, about 200-300 pixels down from the top. And as soon as you scroll past that, it sticks to the top. And the reason is because if you position something sticky and give it a top, right, bottom, left value, when it is supposed to be scrolled out of the container, it will then start to respect those top, right, bottom, left. So mm-hmm. it kind of goes from position relative to position fixed with the caveat of it not doing that weird thing where we used to do this thing where as soon as it scrolled out of view, you would position absolute it. But then by position absoluting it, you would change the flow of the document because by position absoluting it, it gives up its spot in line, and then all the content would jump up really quickly. So position sticky just takes care of that, where the element still takes up its space in the DOM flow, but it doesn't, but it will stick to the top of the page or the top of the scrolling container if you need it. I think that's a pretty neat one, considering how hard that was yeah. with just plain JavaScript.
How much do you use position sticky? Because let's look at the can I use for position sticky, because I feel like it's one of these things that it's now like opened up to be usable now for really like the first time since it's been released. Yeah, still no IE11 support. That sucks. No Opera Mini support. No BlackBerry Browser 10 support. looks like that's a problem.
Position sticky is a nice one, though, because like it's nice. It doesn't have to stick to the right. top of the thing. So it just becomes relative.
Yeah, that's the use case, is when you don't need something to be position sticky. I've had some weird issues with it, too. Some occasionally weird edge casey bugs, but I love position sticky. It's one of those things I wish I could just use all the time with no fallback, knowing that it's going to work on everything. But, you know, we'll get there.
Yeah, I'm trying to build something into the syntax.fm website where the currently playing show also becomes sticky when you are scrolling it, just so that as you scroll through the list of episodes, the one that's currently playing is stuck to the top. There's some weirdness around using sticky, double sticky.
Yeah, double sticky is a little weird. It's sticky. Yeah.
Sticky. So that is the positions. Let's talk about heights. Heights in CSS are a bit of a funny thing as well, because heights and widths do not work the same way. Because if you give something a width, it will immediately size itself if it is a block or inline block element. We'll talk about what those are in just a second. If you give something a width or a max width or a min width, then it will respect that and automatically size itself based on its parent container. But if you give something a height, it doesn't always work. And that's because the height of a container is dependent on the amount of content that is inside of it. And unless it's a position absolute item or you're dealing with a grid or something like that, it will sort of ignore the height that you give it.
Yeah, I think this is probably Stack Overflow's number one question for new CSS developers is like, why isn't my div that has a height of 100% taking up 100% of the height? And I think that is maybe one of the more frustrating aspects when you're first learning CSS is positioning, and you're sort of like, well, it's not doing what I'm telling it to do. Because it makes sense that you would say, hey, give this 100% height, and it's not going to do it. Again, it needs that content, or it needs its parent to be height 100% as well. But now that we have the viewport units or whatever, that sort of takes care of that aspect. For the most part, I think of height and width, or specifically width for in responsive web design, when you're thinking of like non-fluid elements, right? So when you're giving something a height and width, it's not going to adjust when the browser adjusts. So if you make the browser shorter or wider or whatever, if you're giving it saying, hey, this thing is 400 pixels wide, then it's always going to be 400 pixels wide.
Yeah, I think the rule of thumb I tell people is you probably don't want to give something a height unless you're trying to give it a height of 100% or 50%, and you know exactly. Because when you give something a height, you automatically are shooting yourself in the foot for when the content of that element needs to overflow it, right? Yep. And you don't really know what the content of that element is going to be. Maybe you do when you're designing it, but that will change based on the viewport width, based on the font size, based on all kinds of different things that you don't have control over. So I always tell my students, let the content do the sizing of the height and you can do the sizing of the width.
Yeah. I don't find myself using height that much overall anyways. Yeah.
The next question we had was, when do you use the max height and max width, and as well as min height and min width? And generally, these are sort of just like safeguards on either end that you use along with your max height, or sorry, with your regular width and your regular height. So if you don't want something to go bigger or smaller than whatever size that you have, I use max height and max width a lot in Flexbox. Yep. And I find myself when I'm using grid, I don't reach for it all that much often anymore.
Yeah. You'll typically use these things again in responsive things where maybe you have a parent container. Like a good use case, this would be you have your main section of the page, right? The main section of the page, maybe you want it centered so you have a margin zero auto on it, but you always want it to be essentially taking up the full width to an extent. So you would give it like a max width of 1140 or something like that. That way on giant monitors, it sticks and it's only ever that wide. It doesn't get super duper duper wide. Max width, max height. I do find these to be pretty useful. Again, it's just for containing your content within certain bounds, but typically it's for fluid items and things that are changing upon the browser changing. So they also asked about when to use top, bottom, left, and right. And these are primarily used within positioning things. We mentioned relative, sticky, absolute, fixed. So we already kind of went over these a little bit, but really it's just giving things a nudge in a direction or a position in a specific container spot.
Yeah, I think also what's important to say is that usually you'll probably want to use a transform instead of using a top right, bottom left, especially if you're doing animation. Like if you're trying to, like when you hover over something and it moves over or up and over, or
transform,
you're trying
3D.
To just move something. Yeah, you just use a transform and that's going to be more performant for your animations. And generally, it's much easier to work with using transforms than it is from using top right, bottom left.
Yeah. So in that same regard, you know, the transform 3D, even if you're just moving something over to the left or to the right or up or down, transform 3D is going to be putting that on the GPU. So I think in typical situations, it's going to make your animations a little bit smoother. Don't at me if that's totally wrong, but I
is that still a thing?
I've always heard that that's a thing. I don't.
Yeah.
Is it not a still thing?
I always heard that too.
Yeah.
I'm curious if that is still a thing, because I always remember all these tricks where if you want to offload the animation to the GPU and make it buttery smooth, then use Transform 3D.
Yep.
And those tricks, I'm always like, well, then why doesn't Chrome figure it out and offload it to the GPU in the first place? But I still often use that trick because I remember it. And I'm curious now if anyone knows.
Yeah, I always use the 3D transforms. I mean, it's just like any good movie. Like, you know, we got Transformers, but then you got Transformers 3D. You always go for the 3D one. Although Transformers isn't a good movie, so...
Speaking of 3D, there's other things that need depth, and it's your CSS knowledge.
This is my favorite. I love this.
I was trying to convince Scott to use that transition, but it was too bad, though, so I have to say it here. Anyways, we have a sponsor today that is Manning Publications, and they have all kinds of great web development books and videos for you to learn. And today we are spotlighting CSS in Depth in Motion from Chris Ward. It looks to be just under a 3-hour course with 56 exercises. And they go into, cascade,
specificity. I got it wrong.
And and inheritance, working with relative units, mastering the box model, making sense of floats, flexbox grid, position and stacking, and responsive design. So check that out. Manning has a whole bunch of courses on sale just for syntax listeners at deals.manning.com/webdev. So thanks so much to Manning for sponsoring.
Thank you.
Next question we had was, what about relationships between containers and their children in terms of sizing and where things position themselves? So when you position something absolute, fixed, or sticky, it will, by default, it will just go where it used to be, where it was when it was static. But if you apply any of your trouble to it, top right, bottom left, where it sources those top right, bottom left values from on the page is based on its parent. And the way I always describe this when I was teaching is that, let's just use position absolute as an example. The position absolute element will sort of start going up the tree and start looking for a parent that is responsible for its positioning in life.
It's like a child in line that's looking for
its parent. A child that's like, maybe it has its immediate parent might be neglectful. So it just keeps going up the family tree until it finds some sort of element that is position relative or position absolute, or I think sticky as well. So where it bases itself off is where it will find the closest parent that is position relative or absolute. And then where that element is itself is where the top right, bottom left values are derived from. So most likely you're going to just be having some sort of container element. You pop a position relative on there only because you know that in the future, you're going to have a child that is position absolute, and that needs to be the containing element for it.
Yeah, I think that's good. These are all like, it's sort of like going over the same thing over and over again, because it is very like, these things are all so closely related that the concepts all sort of affect one of another. So you explain one, it's like almost like sort of explaining all. And we did briefly mention, but there's some things that we haven't really touched on too much with like the box model and things like that just yet, which are some, you know, somewhat important to this whole thing as well. And we briefly mentioned that there's a difference between block and inline block items and how they sort of respect space. And by default, you may or may not realize this depending on what your skill level is, but each element in HTML has default properties that's assigned to it. And part of these things that are adjusted via CSS resets and stuff like that. But one of the things is that these elements are by default either a display block or display inline or block inline block, whatever. All of the elements in HTML have default properties for this box sizing. And so we often don't think about that, but a div is a div because it takes up its space. It's a position block, right? Where a span is a position inline item and it doesn't take up any space. It just wraps the content. And I think that's important to know throughout this whole thing is block versus inline, inline block, how it takes up space and how it deals with that.
Yeah, maybe we should just rattle through them really quickly. So you've got display block, which is a div, a paragraph, an H1, H2, all of your new tags, article, figure, all of these things are display block, which means that they are, by default, they span across the entire width of its container. Paragraph is, I think I said all of those. Then you have display inline, which things like the emphasis tag, the span tag, the bold and italic tag, which aren't used all that much often. Yeah. What other elements are in line by default? Mark. Do you know about mark, the mark tag?
I don't know about it. No, I never used the mark tag. No.
Let me tell you about the mark tag. So the mark tag is like
mark.
It's for like highlighting stuff. It's for marking content inside of it. And I have many times on my course websites, I want to highlight text. And it's sort of like strong. There's some, you can look up the accessibility differences between it, but it's being able to highlight text using the mark. And by default, it has like a yellow background on it, which is kind of like a highlighter. I thought that was kind of cool.
No, that's interesting. I almost have never used it. I almost would always use emphasis or strong to do any sort of differentiating like that. But no, mark's pretty interesting.
Huh. There is a KBD tag that's in line as well, which is the keyboard input. What other elements are in here are in line? You get the point, right? So these elements do not accept a width or a height. So you can try till you're blue in the face, but they will ignore any width or height that they give them. Why? Because they are, get ready, they are Sparan wrap. Ready? Do you get it? Sparan wrap?
No, I don't get it at all. Okay. I'm really struggling to get it here.
So
yeah.
If you take a span and you wrap anything with a span, the span will just wrap itself around the entire element or the text or anything that is inside of it, and it will not go any wider or higher. It sort of just clings to the content that's in there. So it's like cling wrap. Yeah. It's Sparan wrap.
Yeah. No, right? I'm getting it now. And I think that's pretty good. That's pretty good. Yeah. Yeah.
So if you want to give something like an inline element a width or a height, but still not break the document flow, because a block element will always start on a new line and the content after it will always start on a new line. So if you want to give something a width and a height, but still keep it in line of the document, you can make it inline block. And that will have the same effect as an inline element, except that it will accept a width and a height. And the default for that is a image tag is inline block, which is great because you want to give an image a width and a height, but you also don't want it to necessarily break onto the new line, which is what a figure tag is for. If you do want an image to be on its own line, you should wrap it in a figure and give it a caption as well.
Yep.
So those are the big ones. There's a whole bunch of other ones. There's display grid, display flex, there's display table.
Yeah.
A whole other host of unused one, but I think we're not going to talk about that right now, just as we're trying to understand what the differences are between the two. And then you get into these other elements, like the different sizing of different types of elements. So we talked about paragraph heading tags, those are block. We talked about spans and strongs, those are inline. But then you have these things like image tag. Image tag is inline block. We have an iframe. An iframe is a block element, but many people think that an iframe will size itself based on its contents. But since an iframe doesn't know how big its contents are because it's another web page, there's no way to size the height of it unless you... What's the name of that where you can communicate between an iframe? Post message.
Yep.
You can use this thing called post message, which will allow you to securely send data from an iframe to the parent document and vice versa. And often what you can do there is you can just have like a timer every 400 milliseconds, send the height of the iframe to the parent document. And then the parent document will set the height of the iframe for itself.
Yeah. I think we should even mention too that a lot of times people think they can communicate with their iframes, and to do so, like, the iframe has to be aware of this, right? You can't just iframe, syntax.fm into your site and then just start communicating with Syntax, right? The site has to be aware of it.
Yeah, that's a huge security issue if you could do that, because then you could just quickly iframe in like your bank.com or facebook.com/messages and then screenshot it or dump the HTML content of it. You can't do that unless it's on the same origin.
No.
Okay, last thing I want to say here is that images and video tags are a little bit different because they are ratios based on their content. No other content in the DOM can have a ratio. So if you want it to be like 16:9, you want like a div to be 16:9. The only way to do that is to either stick some sort of image or video that has that ratio in it and then size it up, and it will automatically, you size the width of it and then the height of it will automatically react, or vice versa. Or you can use this padding hack. Have you ever used that padding hack? Where?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I use that all the time. I use it on Level Up actually. So you give something a padding of a percentage of what you want that aspect ratio to be, like a padding bottom of 62.5%. I think it's the 16:9 or whatever to get that aspect ratio going.
So those are the only kind of weird ones. I would love to have native ratios in CSS at some point. That'd be pretty cool to have.
Oh, me too. Yeah, absolutely.
You can keep going.
Cool. Next up, we have the idea of floats. Now, this is one thing that I have not used in a very long time at this point.
Me neither.
Yeah, floats. Basically, the idea of floats in the first place is that you float something to take it out of the flow of the document. If you float it to the left, everything be underneath it in the flow of the document is going to scoot up, and the thing that's floated left will then be shot over to the left out of the flow of the document, and it's only going to take up the space that you give it. So floats were primarily used to do layouts before we had better layout tools. So if you wanted a sidebar on your site, you'd float it left. And if you wanted a content area, you just have it there. And then you'd give things your width and whatever. And then the container would need some sort of clear fix. Now, there's a whole idea of clear fixing, which is what clears the float. Because when you take something out of the flow of the document, the container, the sort of height of the container gets messed up, and it's going to shoot up, and it's no longer going to respect because the item is out of the flow of the document. The container no longer has that structure to hold it up anymore, right? So because of that, we would use on the div, you could use you can overflow hidden on the container. That would clear the fix. You could have a div that would clear the fix. There was like a whole bunch of different things. There was like an after whatever to clear the fix. I have not written a clear fix in any of my code in years now.
I don't think I've written a float, let alone like the use for floats was you have an image and you want the text to wrap around that image.
Right.
That's the only use case that you should still ever use a float. So floats are not bad, but they've just gone back to what they originally used for, which is having an image. Or like another example I use is sometimes I'll have like a blog post and you want to have like a little tip inside of that. Like a hot tip, hot tip, JavaScript is cool. And you want the text to just to totally wrap around the top, the left and the bottom, or the top, the right and the bottom. Floating it will do that. And that's exactly what it's for. But we didn't have layout tools available to us. So people abused it. And we use floats for website layout. And thankfully, you no longer have to do that because we have Fluxbox and Grid now. Yep.
Yeah, pretty much anything that you would have used Fluxbox floats for in layout, I'm doing with Fluxbox, I'm doing with Grid, depending on what my audience is. But if you were still using floats for layout, I would look into just using Fluxbox or something better, more suited for layout itself rather than what that was originally intended for.
And I think that's why people also use like the grids. We talked about grids on the past episode. Like, we don't use grids a whole lot anymore. And the problem was that people didn't understand how to fix these issues that you had when you ran into ClearFix issues. So they just use a grid and it took care of all of those floating issues for you. But it's not necessary anymore, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I think and floats were probably, again, maybe number one or number two on Stack Overflow's CSS biggest problems. And we want to talk about CSS, you know, improving all the time. And, you know, we always talk about Fluxbox and Grid and how they changed how we do things. This is directly how they changed how we do things. And it's going to make things just endlessly easier for new developers picking this stuff up, not to have to worry about why the heck is my container now collapsing, or why is this whole thing weird, or what the heck is a clear fix and why does it even exist? So oftentimes when people would, you know, they'd have these issues, they would run to Stack Overflow, they would read it, and then they'd have to learn a whole bunch of stuff like that. All of these things are bugs that we have to keep track of. And one way that we keep track of bugs over here at Syntax, this is not a good transition, I'm sorry, Sentry. But one of the ways we keep track of bugs over here at Syntax is via Sentry. And you can learn more about Sentry at sentry.io. This is a license JA. It's the place to keep track of your bugs, what's happening in your site, and when something goes wrong, what the problem is. I personally use Sentry on all of my stuff to let me know when things are happening. And one of the coolest things about Sentry is that it keeps track of your bugs in a nice, detailed, organized manner so that you can go ahead and find them, you can address them, you can mark them as resolved, and then you can watch in horror as that bug comes back and you can realize that you didn't actually fix it. It's just an absolutely insanely useful tool for having any sort of code that needs to work, right? If you have a code that is being used publicly and you don't have any sort of error tracking on it, then you are just, it's like you're wearing a blindfold, right? You're purposefully ignoring all of these bugs that could be happening, because it's not a matter of if the bugs happen, it's a matter of when they happen. So, and if you use Sentry for 2 months, let me tell you, you're going to want to be using it for 3 months, and you're going to want to be using it for 4 months and 5 months and so on, because it is totally one of these essential elements of my toolkit. So Sentry.io, coupon code TASTYTREAT. Check it out.
I love Sentry for this stuff. I'm just on my dashboard right now, and it's almost like a game.
It's a game. Because
you're like,
yeah.
Oh, I bet I could bring that amount of errors down, or I bet I could totally eliminate it. And it's just like a constant thing of like, I just want to have a clean dashboard. I want to get rid of them all. And it's really nice to be able to just like look at all the errors that your terrible coding is making happen and figure out how can I get these down, right?
Yeah.
Because it tells you exactly what you need to do if you've got a little bit of time to fix a bug.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Invaluable. Cool. So let's go ahead and talk about, we talked a little bit about Flexbox and Grid already and how they sort of made our lives better from Float. If you want to learn more about Flexbox and Grid, we have a whole episode on Grid. It's definitely well worth your time if you're interested in it. Both Wes and I both have courses on Flexbox and Grid. So there's a lot of content there on this sort of stuff. It's definitely well worth your time. One of the things they mentioned is they wanted to talk about responsive design, media breakpoints and stuff like that, mobile first. And all of this stuff sort of goes into the idea of how do you want your design to be? Do you want it to be fluid? Do you want it to be sort of static where at these given breakpoints it's changing directly, or do you want it to grow with the site and things like that? And we mentioned if you want it to grow, you're going to want to be using max width, that sort of stuff. If you want it to be static, you're going to be using standard width and whatever. But the cool thing about a lot of these new tools like Grid and Flexbox is you can do a lot of responsive web design without even reaching for a media query. There's all sorts of properties here that allows your layout to adjust accordingly and sort of work really well in all device sizes if you're using those new tools.
So a question I have for you, and this is something that comes up all the time, is your media queries, do you do mobile first or desktop first? And the idea behind those two is that do you first design the website as a desktop website and then start to size it down as you make it responsive? Or do you first start with the mobile website and then write media queries as the thing gets bigger and bigger to lay it out? So what are your thoughts there, Scott?
Depends on the project. I think if I have the designs laid out in front of me, like here's the mobile, here's the desktop, here's the entire thing, and these designs aren't going to change, like a designer drops this on my desk and says, code this up, I'm almost always going to go for mobile first. But in Level Up Tutorials land, where I'm designing mostly in the browser and things are changing all the time, I'm reaching for desktop first, and then I'm doing media queries. I sort of actually work backwards. So the code reads mobile first, but I'm not writing it mobile first. I sort of just code it up to get something working in desktop. And then when I do my little refactor, I'll then sort of refactor it to be sort of mobile first. But when I'm writing it, I'm typically writing the CSS code desktop first. And that's for a few reasons. It's because I'm devving on desktop, but also the primary use case of Level Up Tutorials is via wider widths like desktop or a wide tablet or something like that. So for me, you know, first and foremost, the main goal is to have everything as good as possible on wider widths rather than mobile phone with. So I usually start desktop first design and then sort of tweak it as I go and then do a little refactor. How about you?
Yeah, I think the question I always ask myself is, do I feel like I'm undoing a lot of stuff when I'm going to mobile? Did I make things too complex on the desktop and then I have to unravel all of this complexity and set it back to how it normally goes? If you're answering yes to that question, you probably should start desktop first generally, or sorry, you should probably start mobile first, meaning that your site will be very simple. And then as it gets wider and wider, it becomes more complex with the different layouts that you have. Personally, I almost always do desktop first. And especially now with using CSS Grid and probably like 5 or 6 projects that I've done in the last couple of years, I find that it's just so easy to just rewrite the grid at a certain breakpoint. And things just sort of slat and fall into place. So I also get most of my traffic on desktop as well. So you need to be aware of who is. I find that you can often hear people chanting mobile first, and they don't have like that probably works for them. But again, you need to figure out where your audience is visiting your website and what works best for you.
Yeah. And sometimes you even have things like a nav that like the navigation, if you're using the same HTML between mobile and desktop, that's one of those things that's always almost very different between desktop and mobile. Maybe you have it hidden behind a hamburger, maybe you have it whatever, but it's usually a sort of very different situation. In that case, it doesn't matter which one you do because typically the CSS is going to be so different. Like I might have a media query for just mobile and a media query for just desktop and have them totally separate. So I'm not having to do a ton of overrides and stuff like that. So I think there's different use cases for either or, but with these modern tools, I find myself even needing to write overwrites and stuff like that less and less and less because Flexbox is doing so much for me. I'm no longer having to worry about floats and stuff like that. So again, the tools are just making this so, so much better as we go on. And I think with some of these things that we're going to be getting into a second here with these viewport units, these are one of the things that like really makes your life easier. In fact, it was like a couple days ago, I was forced in a situation where I had to write a slideshow from scratch because it was super custom. And I was thinking like, yeah, I'm not really excited about writing the slideshow. I'm just going to hack together. Maybe I should, fork someone else's and hack together because I don't want to write one from scratch. And then the more I was thinking about how custom the slider is, I just didn't want to have to deal with that. So I just wrote it from scratch, right? But then as I was getting into it, I was like, viewport units have made this extremely easy. Like it's been so long since I wrote a slideshow that I didn't realize how easy the CSS has gotten for it because you have things like viewport units. You don't have to worry about calculating widths and stuff like that and all that sort of stuff. So the viewport units, of which is VW, VH, VMin, VMax, are newish. They've been in longer than I think people realize, but newish units that just like pixels or percentages are used for sizing things. The only difference is that these are about the viewport. So if you were to say something is VW 100, then that's going to be the width of the viewport, right? It's going to be width 100% of the viewport. If it's VW 90, it's going to be 90% of the viewport width. So it's important to know that these are always relative to the viewport themselves. So if you say something's VW or 90 VW, right? And you want it to be just 90%, it's important to note that it's going to be 90 of the viewport, not 90% of its container or whatever it's in like that. So occasionally you might think of why would I use percentages? Well, percentages are relative to the container. VW, VH are relative to the viewport.
I really like these viewport units specifically for one thing, and that is perfectly centering something inside of a page.
Ooh.
And the way that I do that is I will grab the body and the HTML tag and put a min height of 100 VH on it. Mm-hmm. Because by default, the body, I think the HTML tag will only be as high as the content that is inside of it.
Yep.
So by setting a min height of 100 VH will automatically make it as high as the browser is. And then if it's higher, it doesn't matter because that's a min height, right? And then you grab your body and you can display grid or display flex and then justify and align center, pops that thing right in the middle. I use this all the time because I always do like these tiny little demos where it's just like one thing on the page and I want it to like look good. So you just center it and it looks good.
Yeah. Yeah. And I use VH again. I mentioned earlier in the episode, I use this all the time on my main element to just say 80 VH. And that way you're never going to have a situation where the footers come in way up. And if your content isn't tall enough, it's like, you know, it's not going to scoot up there and look really weird to give the sort of main area of your site the standard sort of height. And I love to use it for stuff like that. I remember it's just like the sticky footer where you're trying to get the footer at the bottom of the site or something like that. It used to be really just no fun to do. There was like a billion hacks footers, for it. Yeah. I remember just thinking like, this is so dumb. I have all these like extra div elements and percentages and whatever, trying to get this footer to be sticky negative margins and whatever you were doing there. So again, these viewport units are just totally invaluable to me. I use them constantly, especially when just trying to work in anything that relies on the viewport itself.
Yeah, I actually use them a lot in like mobile typography because one thing like you don't even have to be thinking about what is 100%, but if you grab like an H2 tag and give it a width of like 6 VW, then as you resize the width of your browser, the text gets smaller.
What?
And that's almost exactly. Yeah, here, let me send you a pen.
No way. I did not know this. It's like a fit.
Yeah,
text.
I use this because like sometimes I find myself like writing like 7 or 8 media queries, make it smaller as I go along.
I did not know that. That is blowing my mind right now.
Okay, hold on. Where's Slack? Let me send you.
Whoa. This is like a Wayne's World situation. It's blowing my mind right now.
Yeah.
So those of you listening, I hope you've learned a lot from this episode because I just learned something very valuable, something I'm going to be using all the time. This is cool. This is very cool.
Yeah. So what it is you just grab like an H2 tag, say font size 6 VW. And it will just make the font size like you I don't know, you play with it until you find like a happy size. And then as the screen size gets smaller and smaller, your text will just immediately get smaller as well. And what I found is that you don't have to fiddle with font size at any breakpoints because it'll just like it'll kind of scale down with the thing as well, which is pretty cool.
Gosh darn it. That's cool. That's cool.
And go to keycode.info. This is my keycode website, and resize both the height and the width. Of the like hit a code, any key,
press a key, any key. Got it. Yeah.
And then resize the height and the width of it.
I'm resizing the height and the width. I'm grabbing from the bottom right, and it is glorious. This thing's great.
Yeah. So the size of the key code I'm using V. Let me double check what I'm using here. I'm using V min. So I'm saying what V min will give you is it will give you the minimum of the width or the height, and meaning that if the height is smaller than the width, it will give you the height. If the width is smaller than the height, it will give you the width. And what that does is if you sometimes run into situations where the user's browser is really short and wide, or the user's browser is very tall and skinny, and making type fit on that is really easy when you use vmin. So go to keycode.info and just resize your browser on both axes to see that.
Nice. This is great. This is super good. And you can use these things too with like calc or any of that stuff to, you know, modify the value. You could say this is 90 VH plus 5 pixels. If that's, you know, you have a 5 pixel thing going on or something like that. There's just so many cool things you can do with these viewport units. I find myself using them just very, very frequently.
Yeah. Before we had grid, I would use them a lot to do like the fix sidebar, because if you wanted a sidebar to be 500 pixels, and then you wanted the rest to be the rest, you would say the width is 500 pixels, and then the rest of it would be 100 VW minus 500 PX.
So good.
And you can mix and match units there, and it'll just work out.
So good.
Isn't the web awesome?
It's so awesome. And, you know, this is the unironic CSS is awesome episode. I mean, maybe that's what it should be called because it's so good. I've always been a fan, but man, modern CSS, let me tell you, modern CSS is excellent.
So I think that's all we've got here. I think we should do an entire episode. I don't think we've done an episode on Flexbox, have we?
I don't think so. No, we haven't. We can call it Flexin' with the Boys.
People got angry last time we said that. So we can call it Flexible with the Boys, and I think we should also do a Flexbox versus Grid. In my CSSGrid.io series, I have a whole video detailing the differences and the sameies of them.
Yeah, when to use
but
what.
I think it's worth having a episode on the differences between the two as well, because they do have like a large overlap, but then they also do their own thing as well.
Yeah, very specific use cases. And I don't know if you saw, but it looks like SubGrid is moving along nicely. So well, maybe we have a little bit more to talk about in that regard as well.
All right, I'm going to add a SubGrid hasty treat to the list.
Dope. Cool. Sounds good. Well, I hope everyone enjoyed this episode on CSS positioning. Let us know if you have any more questions or sort of weird use cases about CSS. Again, this position stuff, a lot of this stuff on this list that we were talking about got totally invalidated as being issues anymore because of modern sort of stuff. We don't have to worry about floats. We don't have to worry about any of that stuff. We have things like position sticky. We have things like viewport units to make our lives so, so much better.
You got a sick pick for me today?
I do. And I have a podcast. I know my podcast recommendations have been well received here. So this podcast is a little bit different because it has an end date. It's not a continuous one. It's like a mini series. And sometimes these mini series podcasts I like don't want to get invested in, but there's like been a few lately that I'm like really loving the whole thing where a podcast is only 10 episodes and then it's done, right?
Yeah.
Then I end up having a bunch of these podcasts sitting along my thing. But this particular podcast is on a topic that I'm very, very, very interested in, and that's art heisting, art heists. This podcast is from WBUR and the Boston Globe. It's called Last Scene. And there's this art heist. It's one of the most famous art heists in history. It took place in Boston. The Gardner Art Museum was robbed of Vermeer and some Rembrandts, or I think it was a couple of Rembrandts and a whole bunch of other stuff that was like sort of inconsequential, but, you know, important nonetheless. And it's like the most expensive art heist, unsolved art heist, right? And this podcast is 10 episodes and it sort of goes over the whole story, how it happened, you know, who are the main players, and it is fascinating. I've always like really been interested in this art heist in particular. The Gardner art heist is something I've watched documentaries on. I've watched episodes of whatever on. This podcast really opened it up for me, and they spend a lot of time on, you know, who are the key players and basically where the investigation is now. And it's just so fascinating. It's a truth is stranger than fiction type of story. And that's what I absolutely love. The storytelling is excellent. They get a lot of interviews of people that people have never been interviewed before in any regards regarding this art heist. And you get to just see a lot of angles of investigation and stuff like that. So if you're interested in anything like this, anything that's sort of like true crimey or whatever, it's called Last Scene. It is top tier podcast material right here. Love it.
Awesome. That sounds, I've heard that advertised on a few different podcasts. That sounds really good. I'm going to check that one out.
Oh, it's good.
I'm going to sick pick my drone video that is now out. I mentioned it on a previous episode, but IBM sent me a drone to do a video with, which is it's a DJI Tello drone. It's like a $100 little toy drone. And it was so fun to actually code this entire thing. So what I did is I wrote some JavaScript that would power the backend via WebSockets and UDP, and I wrote a front end in React, and it was pretty fun. People tend to like the video as well, so check it out. I'll put the link in the show notes, or I'm just WesBoss on Twitter. You can find it on there. Sick. I think that's it for today.
Shameless plugs.
Let's
get a little silly here. I am going to shamelessly plug my series that'll be coming out this month. Or should be out by the time you're listening to this. It's so crazy. We're recording in the future here.
Yeah.
This series is on design systems with styled components in React. If you are interested in styled components, if you are confused about why anyone would like or want to use CSS and JavaScript, this course is for you. It's all about how to not only see the advantages of using CSS in JavaScript, but also how to build a design system, something that you can elaborate, something that you can scale upon and use. So check it out. It's going to be available at leveluptutorials.com. If you sign up at leveluptutorials.com/pro, you can save 25% off that yearly subscription and get access to a ton of new series. I think I added it up. It's going to be like 700 tutorial videos between the stuff that's already there and the stuff that's coming in 2019. So a lot of content. Check it out. leveluptutorials.com/pro.
Awesome. Good silliness, Scott.
I'm selling. I got my selling hat on.
Another podcast commented that we're too silly on this podcast, where we give ourselves 1 minute at the end of the podcast to plug our own stuff, and it's actually called Shameless Plugs. But I thought that was kind of funny. Anyways, I'm going to plug all of my courses, westboss.com/courses, if you want to learn full stack advanced React and GraphQL, ES6 for everyone, React for Beginners or any of my free courses. I've got more free courses than I do paid courses. CSS Grid, JavaScript 30, Flexbox, Learn Redux, Command Line Power User, Markdown, you name it, you've got it. Westboss.com/courses. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. We'll see you next week.
Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.